Hey Ryan, how you doing?
Hey, Marlon, how are you? We
Yeah,
were we got
not too bad, thank you. Yourself?
I'm great, man. We finally got it. I'm sorry about the difficulties.
That's okay. That's no problem at all. Thanks for appreciate you taking the time out to talk to me.
No, it's my pleasure, man. Where are you at? Or where what city are you?
I'm in the north of the UK, northeast.
Northeast. Okay, cool. Very,
Yeah,
very cool.
the cold
Excellent.
area.
Oh yeah, is it freezing?
Yeah, well, yeah, pretty much.
I'm in sunny Los Angeles, so
quite a difference then.
sorry about that.
That's
Yeah.
okay.
What do you do, Martin? Are you a do you make movies yourself? Are you
Well, I'm just in recruitment at the moment, actually.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, I do like I write for a website reviews and
Oh,
etc.
cool.
Hoping to go back to London the start of next year and go to film school. So
Oh, very cool, man.
yeah,
Excellent. Excellent, excellent.
so I'm just trying to work on my own writing at the moment.
Yeah, that's I mean, that just kind of, I don't know, that it's weird because I all I kind of did before I got into film school was made movies on my own, and I feel like I learned more doing that than I did in film school,
Yeah, a lot of people say that it's just being creative and doing it, you learn so much more.
I think it's true, man. I really think it's true. I mean, film school absolutely like has its, has its advantages. I mean, it's great to have the time and space to watch a lot of movies and make movies and talk to people about movies. But at the end of the day, you go to film school, you make whatever, five or six short films during the course of your studies. It's really about, or if you're writing, it's about just writing your own stuff, just nonstop outside of it, I think. I don't
Yeah.
know. That's what I found, at least. I don't know.
Cool. So yeah, how long have you been making movies since you was a kid
Yeah.
then?
Yeah, I was. My dad kind of brought home the first video camera on the block, and I just instantly started playing with it, And yeah, I was I kind of spent a I wasted my youth.
Not wasted.
I guess. Thank God. Yeah, just behind the camera. But then all through high school, all through secondary school, I was that's just what I did with my friends on weekends. And it was also I learned at some point that you can get away with not doing a report on a book if you made a short film about it instead. And
Right.
so yeah, and so I just started doing that
Oh, that's cool.
constantly, I guess. By the time I graduated high school, I had made like 80 short films with my friends. We were just doing it all the time. But and then after film school, I kind of I wrote Brick like right after film school, and then basically spent my 20s trying to get it made.
Yeah, I mean, that's a it's a great film.
Oh, thanks, man. I appreciate it. Did you start writing early, or are you
No,
just
I'm a late bloomer. I mean, I'm 28.
yeah.
Kind of discovered start of this year.
Oh, that's interesting.
I mean, I used to write, it sounds stupid, but I used to write Lost reviews,
Oh, no shit.
but I only used to send it to my best friends.
That's awesome.
And I used to just send it to them because I never realized I could have taken it anywhere or done anything with it.
Oh my God, man, you could have had like the ultimate Lost blog.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm a late bloomer, so I'm just trying to
Yeah.
play catch up, really. But
That's so funny. It's funny because a lot of the guys who are like the big online writers these days started doing exactly that, or even less than that, started as like a commenter on a site, and they were just like frequent commenters. I know that, like, I think Devin Faraci, who writes for Badass Digest, that's how he started, was just commenting on other people's sites, and it ended up taking off.
just builds from there. I mean, yeah, the site that I write for, it's just come about. A friend of a friend writes for them and started following them, and they wanted new writers, so I just thought, well, why not? I'll send something in. Started
What's
there, so.
the name of the site?
A site called Flickering Myth.
Oh, Flickering Myth. I know Flickering Myth.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great, man. That's a terrific site.
So yeah, it is a good little site, yeah.
That's cool.
So yeah, just trying to play catch up really and putting everything I can into it and my own writing and see where we go.
Well, I didn't. Yeah. Well, I didn't get brick made until I was 30, man. And but more than that, like, you know, I don't know. I always found it heartening to read about filmmakers who really didn't get going until they were even 40. You know, who were.
Yeah.
It's there's you don't think of it in terms of playing catch up. Just think of it in terms of, you know.
Getting it done.
Yeah, and yeah, focusing on your craft, and you know, and also the other thing is like what you were doing before it. That all, especially as a writer, that all bakes into. You know, your knowledge of the world, and it gives you a different perspective, and it's all, you
Yeah,
know.
definitely. So, what was the inspiration for Brick? I mean, it's such
Yeah.
a strange, great film. The noir, but in high school, it's such a unique film in that respect.
Yeah, well, it was, oh, thanks, man. It started with Dashiell Hammett's books. It started at a really definite place of me reading all of Dashiell Hammett's books, and he only wrote a handful of them. He only wrote, God, what did he have, five novels? He had the Red Harvest, The Dane Curse, The Glass Key, The Thin Man, I think that's it, and The Maltese Falcon. He only wrote five novels and then basically drank himself to death. So I read his books, and I had been, obviously, growing up as a film fan, I had been familiar with film noir. I was familiar with kind of the classic film noirs, but that's basically what I knew detective fiction through, were those very stylistically distinct noirs. And reading those books, I felt something really, I don't know, really, really vital. I felt something like it just kind of stirred something up and made me really excited, what I got out of his books. And so Brick was kind of the starting point for Brick was, okay, how do I get what I felt reading these books onto the screen without going through the standard film noir conventions? Because I kind of realized that if you it's hard to do men in hats and, you know, film noir without people shutting off a part of their brains
Yeah.
today, without it just instantly becoming parody. So initially the decision to put it into a high school was just to get around that kind of blockage of the very familiar images of film noir. It was like, okay, well, what if we set it in a setting where you can lean on none of your preconceived ideas about the detective genre? But then once I started working with it, once I got into high school and started working with it, that's when a lot of the deeper connections kind of started blossoming. And that's when I started realizing, wow, this is actually pretty, the connections between the connections between my kind of, yeah, I think we all kind of turn our memories of our teenage years into myth in our head.
Yeah.
And my kind of mythological memories of high school actually connect really well with the scary, very socially stratified world of the detective fiction in these books. And so I just got more and more excited as I kind of connected the dots between those two worlds. And that's kind of how it developed. And so it was those two things. And then yeah, and then the decision for to do the very strange language in the movie was that was kind of because there were a lot of high school movies coming out at that time, and
Just wanted to set it apart, sort
well,
of.
more than that, I it was very important because of where the story was going to have the audience know that this was a heightened reality we were presenting,
Right.
and we didn't have the money to do that with production design. We couldn't create like a Tim Burton crazy high school world.
Oh, that's interesting.
I knew when that first shot popped up, we were just going to be looking at a high school locker cage that looked like, you know, every other high school movie. And so the language, it was a way of very cheaply, the first time anyone opens their mouth in the movie as an audience, you suddenly have to readjust and you have to say, oh, this is, you know, a heightened reality that we're in. And hopefully that would kind of, I hope that would kind of cushion the audience for, you know, where the story was going to go and the level it was going to be kind of playing on, I guess.
Right, yeah, that's actually really interesting. I mean,
Yeah.
it's I just watched it the other day actually, just obviously knew I was coming into this, so I watched it again and Yeah, I mean, it's such a great little film.
Oh, thanks, man. I appreciate it. Yeah, it was weird, but man, it was I got great memories of making. I mean, it was, you know, we shot it at my high school. That's actually the school I went
Oh,
to.
really?
Yeah, San Clemente. Yeah, it's this little beach town in Orange County down here in California, and I think that's why we didn't get kicked out of the school was because by the skin of our teeth managed to hold on and not get kicked out. Yeah, really quick shooting schedule, but I got really good memories of it.
Cool. Now, obviously, this whole thing came about because of Looper, which I saw a couple of times, loved it, thought it was brilliant.
Nice, man.
I wanted to go back for a third time and watch it with that commentary that you released, but unfortunately, I just didn't get round to it.
No.
One of discussions I've been having with people since I've seen it is Sid,
Yeah.
and kind of the ending. And my kind of interpretation of Sid's fate and not knowing whether he's going to become the Rainmaker is that it's sort of Joe's story that's the one that's important, and the whole nature versus nurture aspect. And it kind of leaves you walking out of the cinema asking that question. So if you could just tell me a little bit about Sid and kind of how you saw the ending when you were writing it.
Yeah, it was always about, I mean, you're dead on. It was always about Joe's arc. It was always about taking him from a place of selfishness to an act of pure selflessness. And to me, the key to getting into that was him. It is definitely ambiguous at the end with Sid. You can read it either way. I tried to seed it with a little bit more hope than despair. I tried to be seed it with a little more optimism, but the truth is there's no guarantee in terms of which way it's going to go. To me, the important thing was that that Joe saw himself and this kid and saw the things that he feels went wrong with him in his life in this kid, and he sees a chance to at least fix those to give the kid the best possible shot. And the fact that the stakes are so high, that just hopefully makes the decision all that more crucial, I guess. It's funny, as a from a writing perspective, that arc of Joe's, that selfishness to selflessness, I was actually looking at one of the movies I looked at was Casablanca for that. And I know how familiar you are with the film, but it's that's basically exactly Rick's arc in Casablanca.
Right.
And
I mean, I've not seen that film for a
what's
long
that?
time. I saw it when I was a teenager, and I don't think I've seen it since.
It's funny, if you revisit it, you'll probably see a lot of parallels, or parallels being code for a lot of stuff that I ripped off. Even down to like the Paul Dano's character in Looper is very much serves the function of Peter Lorre's character in Casablanca. Showing kind of, just to kind of show where our character's at the beginning, or the decision to to create this kind of dangerous, broken down world in Looper, and to kind of start by showing out on the streets how bad things are. If you watch Casablanca, that's exactly what they do. They begin with kind of a montage showing how desperate things are in the world around Rick, so that you know why he
The
is
way
kind
he
of.
is.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not because he's a bad person. It's because, he's very much a product of his environment, and that opens up the potential for change, I think, and starts you off kind of at least understanding him, even if you don't, if you aren't entirely sympathetic to him. It's and yeah, and so, and then that's the other thing. Looking outside of, that's the other thing that I really like to do is to, if even though Looper's a sci-fi movie, to look at movies that you wouldn't necessarily connect with the genre for inspiration, to draw from different sources like that,
Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, there's a lot of that in Looper where you've got the horror and the sci-fi, and it all works so well molded together. So it's interesting that you mention the world around being from kind of like Casablanca, because that's kind of one of the things that really stood out to me and I loved was the kind of little technological advances, but really it's just the same world and we've kind of fallen a little bit.
Yeah, that made sense to me. And, you know, it's, I don't know, I feel like, especially because it was only 30 years in the future. And there were a couple of reasons for it. I mean, first of all, it does, from just a futurist kind of point of view, you know, you think about 30 years ago from now was 1982, you know, and if you think about
Yeah.
what really changed between now and then, well, the cars, the street signs, the street lights, the phones that we carry around, the computers, but you know, the streets themselves kind of look the same. The other thing is, and this is something that I thought about, period design in film. I thought about, I forget, I read some interview with a designer who was talking about, if you're making a movie set in 1963, for example, a big mistake that you can make is to have everything in that movie be from 1963
Yeah.
design. You know, you want stuff from the 40s, you want stuff from the 50s, you want hand-me-down stuff. And
Yep.
so, yeah, taking that approach, but with the future to Looper made sense. There was also a, you know, there was also a really distinct narrative purpose behind keeping the reality really grounded, which was I knew that I knew the audience was the audience. We were asking the audience to kind of wrap their heads around quite a lot in that first half hour. And so making the world recognizable, making the world something where it's not some crazy future world where every 2 seconds you have to be thinking, what's that? What's that? But that's basically recognizable. It just kind of cut down on the amount of energy the audience would have to expand in order to get it, which seemed expedient to me just because there were so many other tricky concepts in the film, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it works so well though. We've drawn you into the story more as well,
Oh, cool, man.
and just making it feel. I mean, especially with the tone of the film,
Yeah.
and what old Joe's trying to do, it just makes it all that more visceral,
Yeah.
and that almost that more impactful that it's our world, really.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. And yeah, I'm glad for that. Yeah, and at the end of the day, it was, you know, I don't know, keeping the focus on the characters was it just felt right for some reason. Yeah, there's all this premeditated stuff, but a big part of it is also just kind of going with your gut, and it just felt right to have kind of a grounded future, I guess, you know.
Cool.
Yeah.
Now, where am I? Obviously, when I first watched the film, I avoided pretty much everything going in. So when kind of old Joe Bruce Willis reveals what his plan is, and it's, you know, he's going to go after such a young child. I mean, it's shocking. Just, you know, when that information comes out to you, and you're not expecting the film to go there. And it's pretty dark, really. So, you ever was Sid ever an older character? Was he ever?
That's a great question, man. Yes, he was. Yeah, originally, well, it, or I should say, Sid was always the same in it, but in earlier drafts, it was more the Terminator thing where he had a name that he was going after. And so the other people he was killing in the
Right.
city leading up to Sid were adults. And so it was a change kind of during the writing, realizing that. Well, it was really that I knew that I wanted the audience to make a moral pivot, to make that kind of, oh my God, this is what he's doing, realization that you just described. And when I had him just killing adults in the city, it wasn't getting it there. And it certainly would not have gotten it there if I had known that Bruce Willis was going to be in the movie, because we're used to seeing him, you know. I think that even if you're showing him cold-bloodedly murder people, I think I don't know. One interesting thing was, even as the movie was written, even when we were in the editing room and had the scene where Bruce kills the kid, we found that in earlier cuts of that scene, we actually went relatively light on it. Like, we didn't play the gunshot. We played it very abstract, and we found that audiences were not making that moral turn. They were either refusing to believe that he did it, or they were like making excuses for him, like, well, he must kind of know what he's doing, just because audiences are used to trusting Bruce Willis. And we found we had to lean that moment heavier and heavier and really smack that gunshot and really play that moment hard in order to make that kind of break for audiences, in order for audiences to take a step back and say, wow, maybe I don't trust Bruce Willis in this situation.
No, I mean that, yeah, I mean that gunshot, when then that happens, it's, I mean, it's one of those moments in cinema where you are completely drawn into the story and just shocked in a good way.
Yeah.
Can't quite believe it.
Well, that's great to hear, because that was my main fear, because it's a moment where, you know, it's the type of moment where if it felt inauthentic at all, or felt like, I think for an audience, if it felt like the filmmaker was trying to do this in order to get a rise out of you, was trying to do it in order to shock you, I can see an audience disconnecting from it. And so it was a really critical moment, because I wanted what you're describing. I wanted it to draw you deeper in, not to make you sit back on your hands and say, well, fuck you.
Yeah. And I mean, it's gut wrenching on the first viewing, especially. Yeah. So yeah, it definitely worked.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a tricky moment to play with. We definitely ended up adjusting it, but that's really perceptive. Asking if it was always a kid, that was definitely something we found during the course of writing.
Well, it was the Terminator thing that I was thinking of when, obviously, I mean, John Connor's, he's older, he's a young teen, but he's still very adult.
Yeah.
Whereas going after, you know, such a young child, it's
absolutely,
it's a well, bold move.
Yeah. And having it be an actual, you know, having it be not just a human being, but a guy that we're used to seeing as the good guy in movies, and have him not only that, but acting out of reasons which, when they're stated initially, before you know what he's going to do about them, you agree with his reasons. It's like, oh yeah, he's going to find this terrible guy and, you know, save his wife. It's like all the best reasons in the world. And then actually presenting the reality of what it means to go through with the plan, that turn always seemed really interesting to me, you know?
Yeah, it was, yeah. Sorry, there was something. You mentioned that about it shocking you, and one of the, when Sid blows up in front of Joe and Sarah, you're kind of there with Joe when he's, young Joe, when he decides, actually, I'm going to kill this kid.
Yeah.
You're right there with him thinking, no, that kid's got to go. But then when he sees him out in the corn, I mean, you're right there with him again. He's just a kid. Yeah. I mean, that was a great sequence where, you know, there's all those emotions of that kid has got to go. And then you're like, he's just a kid.
Yeah, well, and from the outset, that was something I was very keen on doing, seeing whether we could ride the audience's allegiances, their moral allegiances, back and forth in kind of a Hitchcockian type way. You know, that was something that was really deliberate when I sat down to write. And, you know, I wanted that genuine conflict. I wanted there to be that same kind of righteous, let's go get them fury, to then be countered by actually seeing the reality of what that fury entails, you know, what carrying out that fury entails. That's really gratifying to hear that it landed like that.
It's a great part of the film. Yeah. And it's like, I know you've talked about, the overall message is, you know, violence begets violence, and self-perpetuating nature of it. And that scene really hits home that in the moment we're so capable of such violence, but then, you know, if we step back, we can, you know, be a little bit more logical about it.
Yeah. Well, and in the abstract, violence as a problem solving tool feels really good to think about, you know, just like, and that's, you know, the same way that, the same way that it's very easy to support a war when you're in your, you know, in your chair at home reading the paper. You know?
Yeah.
it's in the abstract, and it's something which is a very, and that was the other thing that to me was interesting, not even as a message or a position, but just for me, something to wrestle with, because I think all of us, we hear about an event in the news, or we hear about something and you feel that blood rising. You feel that kind of, you know, when some atrocity happens or some terrible person is out there, you feel that blood boiling, and it feels good to think, let's go and get that guy. And it just for me, I know I feel that. It's not
Yeah,
something
no,
I
absolutely.
judge, I think it's something that and the conflict between that and not only the a moral not only morally taking a look at acting on that, but just practically taking a look at it, even if it's the right thing to do to go after and try and kill that person, does it work?
Yeah.
Or does it just perpetuate this loop? That was kind of just the question that I myself was kind of, wrestling with when I was writing
Yeah, I know. I mean, when I come out and when I was talking about it with friends, and
it.
it's kind of that question, obviously, hypothetically, if it's ever possible to travel back in time, those kind of questions will be raised. Do we go back and do we kill certain people? Which it's not the answer, where have we moved on, or are we living in the past still, and are we still.
Exactly. Yeah, and even more than that, it's applicable to now. It's applicable to,
Yeah.
it's I forget like the fantasy idea of going back and killing someone. What about the notion of making the world a better place right now by going out and killing someone?
Yeah.
That just, I don't know, does that get us where we want to be? I know, yeah, it's and it again, it's stuff that's and that's why it was also important to me to have some ambiguity in there at the end. It's something where it's a complicated enough question to where I can kind of arrive at the end to what I think is the most hopeful answer, but it's not something that I've got the moral authority to be didactic about at the ending. It's something that, it made sense to me to have that ambiguity in there just because otherwise you're making kind of like a very definite statement about something that is a very complicated issue, and that doesn't seem honest to me.
No, it's I mean it's he takes the option that of hope. He makes a positive action and hopes that Sid will make the right choices, and then really that's all we kind of can do.
Yeah, it's all you can do, really. Yeah, just kind of put your hope in it. Yeah, absolutely.
But there is one person who you say that rage inside you comes out, and one of those persons you do just want to punch is Kid Blue.
He's so pathetic, though. He's so sad.
Yeah, he is. Yeah, that kind of makes you want to punch him more.
Totally, completely.
I mean, he's a good character, Kid Blue.
Yeah.
And he didn't sort of feel suited to the Gatman position. It seemed a little bit above him. So, are we meant to infer there's something between him and Abe, a kind of connection that
Well,
Kid
it's
Blue wasn't aware
interesting.
of?
No, I mean, it's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I like it's hard for me because I've had people like ask like is I've had people even go so far as to ask, is Kid Blue like a younger version of Abe or something? Which I think, and it's tough for me because I don't
Smashes his
want to.
hand though.
Yeah, exactly. He smashes his hand, and actually, in the original cut of that scene, he then had him dragged out to be shot, and Kid Blue escapes. There's it's. There's like a deleted scene on the DVD where you see like that happen, but I chopped that out of the movie. But yeah, but I think that for me it's more just about the kind of the kind of father son dynamic. They're not father son, but that kind of it's just a reflection for me of the kind of older man younger man relationship that Joe and old Joe have that you see reflected in this unhealthy version of Kid Blue and Abe. But it also, I mean, I the that kind of pathetic, sympathetic, quote unquote villain where it's not that he's like a badass bad guy, but the idea that he and Joe and Noah, the actor who plays Kid Blue, and I, we talked about Kid Blue was probably a looper at one time. He's probably actually like a retired looper who
Right.
kind of just stuck around because he wasn't good at anything else, and so Abe kind of took pity on him and gave him this job.
There's some, I mean, Kid Blue, say, good character, good performance. And there's some other great performances in the film, one of which, obviously, is Sid and Piers Gagnon. What was he like to work with?
Yeah, it was crazy because a lot of times, you expect that with a kid actor, you're going to be drawing the performance out of them line by line, kind of tricking them into giving a performance. And I've never seen anything like it. Pierce was the exact opposite. He was He was 5 years old when we made the film, so he was really a kid. And this 5-year-old kid would come in and sit down across from Emily Blunt and give an incredible straight-through performance of a 3-page dialogue scene.
Wow.
And just front to back. And then you would tell him a couple things to change, and he would do the whole scene again and change those couple things. But then the trade-off was you got like maybe 3, maybe 4 complete run-throughs of the scene, and then he would start getting tired and fidgety, and you would start losing him basically because he's 5 years old.
Yeah, of course,
And
yeah.
but then that's what would be in the movie. So it was strange. Usually with kids, you have to budget a lot more time to shoot the scenes. With Pierce, it actually went really, really quickly. And it's extraordinary. I don't know. He's a kid who can act. You know, he was just he's just had it in him to act. There's the scene actually that I can still watch and kind of be amazed by Pierce is the scene where he and Joe are in the hole waiting for the Gatman to go away in
Yep.
the under the house. And that scene, Pierce actually doesn't have many lines in it, but the amazing thing to me is you can see him listening to Joe, and you can really see him listening. And
Yeah,
that, yeah, you know what I mean? Like you can see it in his eyes, like
he's
him.
just it's just yeah, he's just acting with his eyes. He's got that
Absolutely.
in him that all the best
Yeah.
actors do.
Yeah, exactly. He's listening to the person sitting across from him. He's not waiting for his turn to say the line the way that his mom told him to. He's actually listening to what Joe is saying and absorbing it. You can see that behind his eyes.
And
It's
really
just,
responding in the moment.
yeah, exactly. It's acting. It's acting. It's what real actors do. And that's the only explanation for it. He's a 5-year-old terrific actor.
No, he's definitely someone we've got to watch out for in the years to come. He's going to be.
I'm really curious what he'll end up doing. He's also, I should say, he's got a great mom. He's not, I think he's going to be, I have like Joe and Noah, for instance, were both child actors and they both turned out great because they have terrific parents. And Pierce is the same way. Like I know he's going to be all right. I'm really excited to see what he ends up doing.
Oh, that's good to hear. Obviously, another actor who this year is, he's been on everyone's radar, and this year has been a great year for him is Joe. What's it like working with him again? And I suppose working with him again after such a long time offers a sort of a chance for self-reflection. And how do you see yourself developing over those years?
Well, I don't know. It's tricky for me to answer because we've stayed really good friends over those years. You know, he's one of my closest friends, and it's because we've it's not like we like worked together and then split apart and then came back together for this. Because we've been tight over all those years, it's hard for me to kind of gauge, his development, just because I've developed so much also, if that makes sense, I guess.
No, yeah. I mean, how do you see yourself having developed in those years?
Yeah, well, it's in at the same time, it is very different working with him in Looper than it was working in Brick. Most of that I feel is most of the stuff that I perceive is how I've changed, how I've grown more confident just being on set, and how I've just as a person, you age 10 years, a lot of stuff changes,
Yeah.
So I don't know. It was the same but different working with him this time. But it's also just, I mean, seeing the year that he's had, seeing him be in a fucking Batman movie, seeing like a good friend, do well on that level at what you know that they're great at. It's just, I mean, it's been, obviously with any friend, no matter what they were doing, it's just an incredibly cool thing to see,
Yeah, cool. Obviously, I've said, how much I do like both Brick and Looper and Brothers Bloom. What's sort of next for you? Is there an idea that you've got, a couple of ideas? Are you working on something, or are you just chilling
Yeah,
out at the moment?
no chilling. No, I'm yeah, when I finished up Looper, I didn't have anything like in the bank. Like I mean, not money wise, I mean idea wise, I didn't have I didn't have any ideas lying around. And so I just started thinking, and I came up with a few different ideas, and now I'm at the point where I've narrowed it down to one, and I am actually bearing down on it and starting the writing process. I've got to,
Okay, brilliant.
yeah, I've got to try and get faster at writing though. I want to get this one turned out because it took me like a year and a half to write all, Looper and also Bloom. I've been really slow. I want to see if I can turn this one out quicker and, be making a movie sooner. But it's,
I mean, it's working for you so far, so.
well, yeah, but at the same time, it ends up being a few years in between movies. I had so much fun making this one. I want to
Want to
be,
get back to that.
yeah, I want to get back to that. And there's also, this is the first time I've ever had a movie that's done well, in theaters. And so there's a certain amount of a feeling of kind of, strike while the iron's hot, I
Yeah.
guess. You can't really go by that, but that's something that's just deep in the back of my head. But the truth is, at the end of the day, the script will take the time it takes. And
So, do you find writing an easy process, or is it something that really is a pain?
it's miserable, man. It's terrible. It's really okay. I don't know if you feel the same. I love having written, but actually writing is not.
No, I mean, yeah, I feel the same when I'm trying. It's so many ideas, but trying to actually write, yeah, it's a pain.
Yeah, just sitting down and doing it, it's just like I don't know, and it feels like it's I don't want it feels like it's getting harder.
A friend of mine said it's like running. You've just got to make yourself go and do it.
It's so true. Yeah, no, you need that discipline. And I've never worked as a professional writer. I've only written my own movies. And so I really envy my friends who are like working screenwriters who have that discipline of sitting down every day and turning out pages. I never developed that, and it's something I feel like I need to kind of figure out, I guess, but I guess also with doing what you're doing, writing on assignment for a website, that gives you that same kind of discipline of whether you feel like doing it or not, you gotta,
Got to be done, yeah.
gotta be done.
Definitely, procrastination is my middle name,
Yeah, so bad. Me too. Yeah.
Now, obviously, I mean, we've mentioned Batman. I'm a huge Batman fan, comic book fan.
Yeah.
Hypothetical situation: Warner Brothers rings you up. Next Batman movie. Would you do it?
I like that hypothetical.
Several friends have asked me to ask you that question, which I was going to ask you anyway.
I mean, I love Batman. I didn't grow up reading the comics, but the Batman movies, like when that first Tim Burton Batman movie came out, that kind of defined, in a weird way, for me, for specifically like the generation that I was in, that first Batman movie in a way defined what a blockbuster was for me, more so
Yeah,
than Jaws
absolutely.
or any of the 70s, any of those 70s movies. For me, when that first Batman hit, there was kind of a cultural, but it was kind of this cultural volcano that defined what the superhero blockbuster was in a way that was just completely drew me in as a kid. So Batman is definitely like the one superhero movie franchise that I'm 100% just completely in. And I love Nolan's films so much, man.
Yeah, and
I mean, I yeah, and it, You know, I right now I'm just focusing on doing my own thing, and that hypothetical that you mentioned has so many variables to it in terms of what kind of movie they're looking to make and this and that. So, right now I'm just I hate to dodge the question a little bit, but
that's fine. It was, I mean, I say, I just it's a bit of a
that call
fun.
hasn't happened, and in the meanwhile I'm not going to sit by the phone. I'm just going to keep writing my own stuff.
Yeah, no, brilliant. And say I look forward to whatever comes next. So,
Thanks, man. I
and
appreciate it.
yeah, I appreciate you taking the time to talk to me, Ryan.
Lauren,
I
thanks so much,
do.
man.
And
It
I'll ask one final question before you go.
was
What's your
good.
favorite time travel movie?
Oh, let me think. I don't know if I have a number one favorite. I like different ones for different reasons. And then like my list of like my top five or whatever, they're all such different movies. Like Primer is definitely in there. Have you seen Shane Carruth's movie Primer? Have you seen that
I
film?
haven't, no. It's on my love film, though. That's Netflix.
Okay, great. It's pretty tremendous. But I mean that. But then Back to the Future is the first Back to the Future, and there's couldn't be more different. Or 12 Monkeys.
Donnie
Did you see?
Darko is one of my favorites as well. Just
Yeah, I guess Dark
Completely
does have
different.
time travel element to it. Yeah, absolutely. It's funny, I went to school with Richard Kelly.
Oh,
He
really?
was, yeah, we were in the same class making Super 8 movies.
Oh, brilliant.
Oh, I was gonna mention, have you seen Time Crimes?
Time Crimes.
Oh, yeah, look at that up on Netflix. It's a brilliant little Spanish movie. It's kind of like a great little self-contained time travel mousetrap. It's really worth looking up.
Right, cool. Yeah, I shall do that.
Yeah. But those are the usual suspects, I guess.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks for your time, Ryan. Really do appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Martin. Take care, man.
You too. Cheers.
See ya.